Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And unfortunately, Haley Bird Wilt could not be with us on this episode, but we have what I think is a really fun discussion inspired by a TV show that we all love here on Hoth Takes. We'll get to that in a second, though, because before we even get into this episode, as we're recording, it's just a few days after the teaser trailer for the second season of Andor was released online. And Grace, when we were talking about doing this episode, you said, "That sounds great, but first, we've got to spend a few minutes talking about the Andor teaser trailer." I have no idea what you're about to say, Grace, so I'm just going to turn it over to you. What is so important that we need to get this out of the way up front before we get to the show?
I mean, first of all, I feel like we've been waiting for an Andor trailer for ages and ages and ages, and finally it is here. But as we are all big Andor stans on this show, I thought it was important that we discuss it. The thing I just needed to get off my chest is I am vaguely concerned with how they were marketing it and the rollout of it. So I think it's going to be rolled out over 4 weeks with 3 episodes per week. And first of all, I don't love that. I think it should be 1 episode per week and over 12 weeks. It feels very rushed. And it's like, why are you rushing this? But then the trailer seemed like it was very focused on like the critical acclaim that it got. So there were lots of blurbs of reviewers saying how great the first season was correctly. But then the music in the background and what was shown in the trailer seemed very action focused, and it didn't really highlight at all some of the more political themes of Andor, which is what made season one so good was the politics of it. And it just felt very like we Disney, the corporation, are just going to tiptoe around politics with this trailer, which on the one hand is understandable that they would want to tiptoe around politics right now, but also politics are a huge part of what Andor is. So this doesn't mean that I think that the second season won't be delving into those politics. I found it somewhat concerning how it was marketed, and then also somewhat concerning that they want to rush the release as if they want to just kind of get it over with. So those were my thoughts.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about the release schedule. It does feel rushed. It feels antithetical to the whole vibe of season one, where we did get to kind of revel in having 12 episodes, which is unheard of for Star Wars these days. So like the rollout almost, like the season one rollout almost made me feel like I was watching a classic broadcast show in terms of how long we got to spend in that universe. And now, I mean, this feels like what they do with a show that gets a mid-season premiere just in order for them to finish off the show. And they kind of throw it together and they kind of cram it into a few weeks so that they can say they released it. But it's clear the network doesn't actually want to spend too much time, too much airtime, and too much marketing time having it be front and center. That's kind of what this feels like to me. I'm sure that Tony Gilroy and Disney would say, these are 4 3-episode arcs, and we want you to be able to see each arc all at once so that you really get the full impact, and then you wait a little bit, which is sort of synonymous with or analogous to, I guess, the time jump, and then you come back and it's been some time. I get that. That's not the worst idea in the world, but it also means that this is going to be crammed into a short period of time. Andor has less time to kind of dominate the headlines. All the energy and buzz that it got for being on the air for 12 weeks last season is going to be very different this time around. So I agree with you about that. In terms of the teaser trailer, part of me wants to just say, when you're trying to tease it and you want to get people into the mindset of, oh, right, Andor is coming back, you can do that with a mass market, look at how action-packed this is, and then you come back later with a real full trailer that delves more into the story. But part of me also thinks you're right, Grace, that we find ourselves in a moment where a lot of corporations are approaching the idea of revolution and insurgency and fighting power very differently than they used to. And I do see Disney potentially taking part in that here. So I hope I'm wrong. I hope that this is more just about start with the action, hook them, and then give them the story in the full trailer. But like you said, you know, we don't really know. And there's reasons to think Disney might be shying away from marketing this the way that I think a lot of folks expected it to.
Exactly, yeah. I'm glad that we are of similar minds on this, because I just needed to get this off my chest before we did any other kind of conversation. So I'm glad we are of the same kind of opinion that, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean anything for the quality of the show itself. I don't think it bears on the quality of the show in season two at all. But I think it does say something about how Disney views the show right now.
Yeah, I'm also glad we agree, because whenever we disagree, it always makes me wonder, like, wow, you know, Grace is usually right about so many things. Is it possible that I'm wrong here? And, you know, there's a first time for everything, but I'm glad that in this case, at least we're in agreement, so I don't have to worry about that. So speaking of history and politics and timelines and rich tapestries of storytelling, one of the shows that we here love here at the Hoth Takes crew is For All Mankind. It's an Apple TV show, and the premise is essentially, how would American space exploration relations with Russia have been different if Russia had gotten to the moon first? What would that have done to our path into the stars and beyond? And that alternate history premise is great for unlocking a lot of cool storytelling on For All Mankind. And so it got me thinking, what if we did similarly here in the Star Wars universe, our own alternate history storytelling? If we could do, for example, a Star Wars TV show with that same idea, starting from what if one thing is different, what are the kinds of stories we'd like to tell? Now, some folks who are fans of the Marvel Universe might be thinking of their new animated, or the recent animated TV show, What If, which explores a similar premise where you have characters doing things differently from they did in the main timeline. And I think that it's kind of interesting to think about Star Wars in the same way, because so many of these events are interconnected, where if one little thing is different, that just the whole tapestry unspools differently. So we've each got some ideas here, and I thought maybe we could make our case for, if you're sitting down with Bob Iger and he says to you, pitch me a Star Wars version of What If, what are some of the storylines you're going with? So Grace, if you'd like to go first, you can pick one of yours and do your elevator pitch here. Sell me on the idea of these alternate histories.
So first of all, I think a Star Wars What If would be awesome. And we already know that Star Wars can do really cool animated stuff from Clone Wars and Rebels to the more recent Visions and Bad Batch. So I feel like this is in the realm of possibility. So I had a few ideas for some alternate universe ideas, AUs, as we say in the fan fiction community, that I would be really interested in seeing. But I think the one that's probably the biggest truest big what if is a twin switch what if. So what if it's not Luke Skywalker and Leia Organa? What if it's Leia Skywalker and Luke Organa? What if the twins were sent to different families? Leia was raised on Tatooine with Owen and Beru, and Luke was raised with the Organas on Alderaan. And I think this is a really fun alternate universe idea, because it really brings up the age-old question of nature versus nurture. So how much of the Luke and Leia that we see in the original trilogy, how much of that would carry over into this particular what-if scenario? I think it'd be really fun to see Leia with, like, her brashness and her, like, anger being in the Luke position, being you know, this dreamer who wants to get off of Tatooine. Would she be in the same sort of longing place that Luke is, or would she be, you know, more frustrated about it? Would she be trying to escape her circumstances more than Luke with his, you know, toy plane and power converters to the Tashi station. Like, would she be any different under those same circumstances? And then Luke, I think Luke is such an interesting protagonist because in a lot of ways there's a lot of gentleness to him in a way that isn't traditional necessarily for male protagonists. And I would really love to see some of his like inherent empathy being wielded in this sort of political manner, and him being more of a diplomat. I just think it would be really fun to see like the ways in which they would be the same as their current iterations and the ways in which they'd be different. And then there's just like the fun of having, you know, Leia training to be a Jedi and Luke being a rebellion leader on the political side. It's just, it's something that occasionally I see fan art for this scenario, and I always think it's really fun. So I don't know, there's something about it that just captures my imagination.
Yeah, and I think that point you make about their personalities and how much of it is nature and how much of it is nurture is so core to like what would make this interesting, because Leia does have that fire in her. Luke does have that sort of that gentleness, that earnestness to kind of always do the right thing and also like always see the good in people.
Right.
And I think like that especially would be so interesting as like as a senator, like a junior senator, basically that whole like trajectory of Leia's life up until the Battle of Yavin. Luke in that position instead, I wonder if he would be as like tactical as Leia was, working with Bail to kind of, you know, help the rebellion. I wonder if he would thrive in the role that she occupies in the actual timeline, or I wonder if he would be maybe diverted toward more humanitarian. I mean, Leia does humanitarian work and she cares about it, obviously, but in many cases it's a cover for helping the rebellion. I wonder if Luke would be like almost more interested in just kind of pure unvarnished humanitarianism and less eager to get into the kind of political machinations that Leia is so eager to do, you know, along with her father.
I feel like there'd probably be some discomfort in the role for him, which would also be in keeping with the actual original trilogy as well, because that's something Luke struggles with a lot is the weight of expectations that are placed upon him. And I feel like that is something that he would continue to struggle with, only more on the political side. But at the same time, I think, you know, there's something to be said about like a young Luke speaking passionately and being able to sway people to the rebellion, being able to speak with that kind of empathy. And this is not to say either that Luke isn't strong and powerful in his own right, because we see, I mean, the original trilogy is very much the hero's journey of him becoming more to just put it plainly, becoming more of a badass over three movies. And I think that, you know, maybe if he was forged in the fire of politics and traveling to Coruscant and learning everything from Bail, and oh god, what's Bail's wife's name? Breha. Learning everything from them, you know, maybe he would grow up to have that bit of canniness. And because he's just so young, like he's like a real 19-year-old in A New Hope, and Leia's like a 19-year-old that's had to grow up too fast. So maybe in the reverse, Luke would be the 19-year-old who has the weight of a planet on him, the weight of a rebellion on him, and Leia is the one who is just like a scrappy fighter who wants to get off her planet. So I feel like it'd be interesting to sort of see that dynamic.
Yeah, and I wonder if Owen would make Leia do as much manual labor on the farm. Like, do you think he'd be like, oh no, this isn't woman's work?
You know what? No, because Beru is clearly such an equal partner in mm-hmm. the farm. And we especially saw that in the Obi-Wan show, which was one of my favorite parts of the Obi-Wan show. I think he would be just as gruff and cranky, but maybe he would also be like, maybe he would have like a girl dad energy. maybe he would be like exasperated with her, but also, you know, very like, rawr, 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 you're a good kid, Leia. I don't know. I think he could have girl dad energy.
Like he would take her to the concerts at Mos Espa. Yes, and like wear exactly. the t-shirts.
And be very, you know, cranky about it. And be like, I don't see why we have to watch this for the third time. But I don't know. I could see that being a fun family dynamic too. I also wonder if Leia would more readily seek Obi-Wan out and be more curious about old Ben Kenobi and like badger him.
Yeah, it's so much of this is like nature versus nurture. I know I said that before, but I tend to think that a lot of who they ended up being is based on the people who raised them. And so I kind of wonder if like if Owen and Beru were raising you, would you kind of pursue the same path even if you're Leia instead of Luke? How much of it is like genetically predisposed to like curiosity or confrontation or diplomacy? You know what I mean? Like so much of that.
Exactly.
I think it does come from who raises them, but there's part of it is there is biology and there is, you know, they're probably going to be treated differently in certain circles if they're a woman versus a man. I mean, I think Leia is perennially underestimated in part because she's a fairly slight, kind of short-ish woman. And so yeah. when it's Luke instead, who's not the Incredible Hulk, but he's a broad-shouldered, you know, strapping young lad, does he get treated differently in the halls of diplomacy? I don't know.
The other thing that, you know, has been raised to me when I've posed this theory is, would this, like the switching of roles, go with like the love story of the original trilogy as well? And my answer is, I don't see why not. So Luke Organa and Han Solo, why not? I actually do think that would be kind of fun for the Leia Skywalker, like having a female protagonist with no love interest at all in the movie series, at least. I think that would be pretty neat, and I don't see why not. So that's the only other thing I will say about this AU.
Yeah, we've only had one trilogy where the female lead doesn't end up with the sort of, you know, depraved psychopathic man child out of three. You know, it's only the original trilogy is the one where the female lead doesn't have a romantic relationship with a man who is really no good for her.
But she still is in a romance. Like, yes. she doesn't escape that.
No, that was just mostly my attempt to make a disparaging comment about Kylo Ren.
Kylo Ren, yeah.
Which don't come at me. I understand there's a lot of folks out there. To me, okay, that's a whole other subject. All right. So the one I want to start off with here by pitching is, what if Anakin arrives too late to stop Mace Windu from killing Palpatine in Revenge of the Sith? Anakin has told Mace Windu, Palpatine revealed himself to me to be the Sith Lord. Mace Windu says, stay in the council chambers, I'll deal with this. And he goes, and there's a big fight. He almost kills Palpatine. I tend to think that that was genuine. Palpatine wasn't holding back too much, that he really did get the better of Palpatine. What if he killed Palpatine? We have to think about all the spillover effects that basically the rest of Revenge of the Sith doesn't happen. So obviously, the grand plan, Palpatine's grand plan, doesn't play out. Order 66 doesn't happen. The Jedi don't get slaughtered. We don't see an empire. But Anakin is still charging in there thinking, I need Palpatine's help to save Padme. So his role here is the same up to that point. He's distraught. He runs in. He's too late, but he's not exactly happy with Mace Windu. He thinks he's just lost his big chance to save his wife. And of course, there's the rest of the public. There's the Senate. What do they do in response? This would be a really interesting, I think, like a topic for like a political thriller where, you know, the Jedi now have to figure out how to message, you know, what Mace Windu has done. And by the way, it's not like the rest of the council has a meeting and says, yes, Master Windu, go ahead and do this, right? Mace probably has some reporting to do to the council. He's probably got some explaining to do to the rest of them about why he had to take it this far. Then you've got the Senate wondering, was this actually a Jedi coup? Because remember, that was Palpatine's claim in Revenge of the Sith. Well, here, it actually looks like it worked. So does the Senate believe Mace when he says, look, this guy was a Sith Lord? Does Anakin, who is not exactly happy with Mace at this point, back him up and say, yes, I didn't want to kill him, but he did tell me and show me that he was the Sith Lord? Does the Senate believe even that there could have been a Sith Lord, right? I mean, now you have all these senators who worked closely with Palpatine having to confront the possibility that he was lying to them, manipulating them, deceiving them this whole time. Are they willing to own up to that possibility? And then, you know, the general public, right? So we could see in Clone Wars how even before Revenge of the Sith, Palpatine was kind of promoting the idea subliminally that the Jedi were too powerful. You know, there's a Clone Wars episode, I think, where there's a fight on Coruscant, and there's a video screen in the background of Palpatine talking about the Jedi and very ostentatiously denying the idea that the Jedi are getting too powerful, something like that. He's clearly planting that seed. So yes, he's gone, but does the general public just, like, do they trust the Jedi? Do they trust Mace Windu? Do they believe that this was what we, the audience, know it was? I think there's a lot of opportunities there for complicated, dark, psycho-thriller, political drama-type storytelling. But I don't know if you've got any ideas there.
I mean, first of all, I love how deeply you thought about this, because when I saw in our notes that was your one of your alternate universe scenarios, my first thought was, man, that would be funny. Like, that would just, setting aside all of the ramifications, that would be objectively funny for Palpatine, you know, all of these dominoes that he has been setting up for decades, and then he just freaking beefs it right at the very end, right when it matters most. He just eats it and dies and gets killed and all of his plans for naught. So that, I thought, was my initial thought, which I don't think you actually could really play it for humor, but maybe there could be a little bit of dark humor in there. I think there could be, about, like, you know, all of his plans and what happens now with all of these loose threads that he's been setting up. He set up, again, all of these dominoes, and the thing that was going to push it over is now no longer pushing it over. So I feel like there's some, like, even though he kept all of his plans very close to the chest, I feel like there's something there where you could be talking about or showing some of these loose ends that are just hanging in the breeze now. I do really love how you've taken it in this political angle, though. And the other thing that I wanted to point out, and would be interested to see, is, yes, Anakin knows that Palpatine's the Sith Lord. Palpatine straight up confessed it to him. But at the same time, we know Anakin was super conflicted, and not just because Palpatine said he knew how to say Padme, but also because he's been a mentor to Anakin for 15 years almost. Anakin's one of those dominoes. He's been taking very, very good care over the past decade and a half to really ensure Anakin will become his faithful follower. And not just through Padme, but just, you know, by being a mentor figure. So how does Anakin react in terms of, does he back Mace Windu up? But also, how does he react in terms of losing one of his key mentors?
Yeah, I mean, if I were doing this as a show where I had time to kind of unspool threads over time, as opposed to just one, like, what-if episode, Anakin would be that wild card where, like, he doesn't, like, he kind of keeps his, like, he kind of plays both sides a little bit, where he's, like, he doesn't go out and, like, tell the public, like, no, the Jedi are lying, it was a coup. Like, he doesn't explicitly oppose the council, but you kind of see in how he talks to them and how he like does interviews afterwards or whatever, that he's not like fully ready to like jump on board with them. And he's kind of like a loose cannon. They're worried that like, yes, this is this man who was mentoring him for a long time is gone. And, you know, they don't even have to know about the whole like he promised he could save Padme. For them, it's enough to know this guy was his mentor and now he's gone and he wasn't there. So he didn't actually see Mace Windu kill Palpatine. That's very important. He doesn't know for sure what happened. And I would have him going through his Jedi duties and dealing with the aftermath of the failed coup or the failed takeover. And I would have him do it in this very unstable way. I don't know. You know, here's a question for you, Grace. If you want Anakin to be that kind of loose end, that kind of person where you're never sure where he's going to come down in terms of where his alliances will lie, do you let Padme live or do you find some other way to take her out of the picture so that Anakin is bereft, unmoored, whatever you want to say? Because I feel like she would be a grounding influence on him if she were just totally fine. I think that, like, you already saw her and Mon Mothma and others expressing concerns about Palpatine's level of power. So I think she, if she survived, would probably believe the Jedi and Mace Windu about Palpatine, and she'd try to get Anakin to come around to that idea. And also, if she's fine, it doesn't matter as much that Anakin doesn't have Palpatine around anymore. So what would you do with her in that situation?
So this raises a couple of questions for me. a question, an answer to your question. So first of all, a what if that I have in my head that is just from, you know, me as someone who enjoys tragedies, but one of the best part of tragedies is being like, ugh, if they had only done this or that or this, things could have been different. And one of my favorite what-ifs for Revenge of the Sith is, what if Anakin had just freaking communicated with Obi-Wan, who really is like his brother, mentor, father figure type guy who would definitely help him out? And so first question that I think answers your question, I guess, is does he turn to Obi-Wan? Does he try to do everything by himself now? Or does he accept, no, if I can't get help from Palpatine, then I need help from someone else? And maybe that isn't Obi-Wan. Maybe that's Yoda, but I feel like Obi-Wan would be the one he would turn to. Actually, as I'm talking about this, this raises a corollary question, which is like, there's the theory that it's Palpatine somehow making Padme sick. So if Palpatine's dead, is she still even sick? So there's that question. But then the other question I have, and now I think this would be really interesting, is what if this scenario, what if Padme doesn't die, but what if she drifts away from Anakin anyway? What if they end up, their relationship ends up being fundamentally broken by this? Because we know that she's always had more revolutionary spirit than he does. And so what if she takes this opportunity to really be like, let's reshape the Senate, let's reshape the government, let's find all of these loose threads and just tie them off. And either because she's so involved in government or because she's fundamentally has different political views than Anakin. You know, what if he's grieving his mentor who also happened to be a Sith Lord? And meanwhile, Padme is like, okay, but this guy did a bunch of super messed up stuff politically, and now I need to undo that. And she isn't able to see Palpatine in the way that Anakin sees him, and Anakin isn't able to see Palpatine in the way Padme sees him. And I think would be super duper interesting. You know, their love has always existed within the prism of war. So what happens when you take that away? What happens when the fundamentals of war are no longer there and they're no longer going to be there? And, you know, she's pregnant and going to have twins. So how's that going to factor in? You know, being a parent is hard. And did they ever actually think about how Anakin was going to co-parent when he was still being a Jedi? Like, did they ever actually talk about that? Whole bunch of questions here that we now can actually get answered.
Yeah, I mean, when you said there's all these loose ends to deal with, one of them is the war itself. I mean, Palpatine was running the entire war. So what happens when the Separatists are like a wind-up toy that's just been wound up and left to kind of chug along on the ground? Like, they, I mean, I guess it depends when you make the change in the story, because when Mace Windu tries to kill Palpatine, Grievous is already dead. You know, Count Dooku's already dead. So if you really take that exact moment to change things, you could argue the Separatists were about to be defeated anyway. But maybe in this story, there's some other leader who's able to step up on the Separatist side and seize power and keep going, right? Because when in the actual movie, Order 66 happens and Palpatine has Anakin shut down the droid army and kill the Separatist Council. If none of that happens, it's possible that even without Dooku and Grievous, the Separatists find a way to keep going. So, you know, you were saying, Grace, like, what happens when the war is over? I don't know that the war would end in the short term. And I think that while you're right, it's really interesting to think about what would happen after the war. Does this relationship that's been forged in conflict actually survive in peacetime? I'd be curious to see, if we just set this premise going, how long would it actually take to end the war? Could the Separatists keep going when Palpatine isn't behind the scenes screwing up things for one side or another in order to prolong the conflict?
And then there's the question. I feel like there are so many questions that they just didn't think about. Like, what do you do with all the clones? Where do all the clones go? What's their purpose now? When I tend to think that even if the Separatist Council still exists and still puts up a good fight, like, you put a targeted team of Jedi on them and they're done. There's a power vacuum. There's only been Palpatine for a long time. So when he's gone and Grievous is gone and Dooku is gone, I tend to think that, you know, the banking clan ain't gonna cut it. So I feel like you send a SEAL Team 6 of Jedi and they're probably done for. And that doesn't mean there won't continue to be skirmishes around, but then what do you do with this massive standing army entirely of clones that also ages at an accelerated rate?
Yeah, and also if there's never an order to shut down the droids remotely, if they never ever make it to Mustafar and find that control switch, you also have the possibility of droids out there in the wilds of, like, you know, the equivalent of, like, in the jungle of Brazil, like, continuing the fight in this guerrilla style, because they're still active. Nobody found their off switch. The war is over. But do some of them decide to keep going? I think that would be, like, that could be almost like your comic relief element, is like them trying to be guerrilla fighters, but still being B1 battle droids and being completely inept. All right. So that we kind of, like, we covered a lot of ground there. Grace, I know that you mentioned, you know, one of the ideas that you had was, what if Anakin really does open up to Obi-Wan in Revenge of the Sith? Is there anything about that that we didn't cover in my hypothetical that could maybe spin things off in a, like, a different direction?
I just think, you know, I guess the difference here would be, what if Anakin communicates with Obi-Wan? That doesn't necessarily mean Palpatine would die. I feel like there's a potential scenario where Anakin communicates what's happening with Obi-Wan and then is too late to, not to save Palpatine, but too late to save Mace Windu. And there's the idea of, what if Anakin becomes a leader of the rebellion? And sort of, how does the rebellion look, and how's the Empire look if Anakin doesn't become Darth Vader? Like, if, let's say, Order 66 still does happen, the Empire still is created, what does that look like without a Darth Vader? What does that look like with Anakin on the good side, and Padme alive, and Obi-Wan, you know, him telling his best bro what actually happened? Like, there's a lot that would have to go right here. But I tend to think that if Anakin tells the truth to Obi-Wan about everything and is like, genuinely, I really need your help, that Obi-Wan would be like, yeah, let's figure this out, bud. And I see sort of a happy ending, a happier ending within the tragedy writ large of the rise of the Empire and the fall of the Jedi and the fall of the Republic.
Well, and let me add another wrinkle. What if they do have that productive working relationship there. But then at some point, either in Order 66 or afterwards, Obi-Wan is killed. And so then it's not Obi-Wan mourning what he thinks is the death of Anakin on Mustafar and, you know, just ruminating on, I have to protect Anakin or I have to protect Luke. What if it's Anakin mourning the loss of Obi-Wan, you know, seeing basically how Order 66 unfolds? Maybe he's even aware somehow that Palpatine wanted him to be the tip of the spear and that he kind of feels like, there but for the grace of God, I could have done some really bad things, but thankfully Obi-Wan talked me off the ledge and now I'm fighting against the bad things. But what happens within that context that you just set up if he doesn't continue to have Obi-Wan as a steadying presence while he is participating in and leading the rebellion?
Right. I think that's another really good wrinkle to it. I guess the larger scenario is also just could more succinctly be called, like, what if there isn't a Darth Vader? And I think that could be really just generally interesting to see how does the Empire look without Palpatine's number one enforcer. Does it still work as well? Because we know that Palpatine had lots of other loyal lieutenants who were willing to serve his whim, but how does it work without his number one guy? Who's to say?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of our what ifs are turning on the idea of, like, what if somebody dies instead of somebody else? you know, which is how a lot of conflict and storytelling happen anyway, so it makes sense. But one of my what ifs is, what if in A New Hope, Luke fails to blow up the Death Star and it destroys Yavin 4 and the Rebel base? What's interesting to me about this is that it kind of feels like the sequel trilogy in the sense of there's some remaining good guys, but a significant chunk of the good guys' resources and leadership and personnel have been destroyed. What does that do to the good guys who live on? In this case, of course, you know, most of the characters that we have spent at least one movie with, and I guess you could say if you've seen the prequels, you know that, you know, Leia was, you know, around and she was Luke's sister and yada yada, they're gone. And the only person left, I guess Han is still out there with Chewbacca, but, like, you know, Leia's gone, the rebel leadership is gone. You could retroactively say, well, Mon Mothma was there as well. I mean, we know that she wasn't there, but in this universe, maybe they have her on Yavin 4 and she's gone too. What happens to the cause when the strategic genius is gone and Luke doesn't have that moment of validating his strength in the Force, but also, like, kind of sending a signal to the rest of the galaxy, right? If the Death Star wins that fight, is there any hope at all for the rebellion? I guess that's how I would frame it to you, is, like, how dark does this show get if you're starting from that premise and you're really talking about an asymmetric insurgency? You know, we know from the comics and everything that the Yavin 4 contingent is just one part of the rebel fleet and the rebel military, but there's a huge psychological blow here. So I guess I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, like, out in the galaxy, when we don't have the propaganda victory and the people who are starting to question whether, in fact, the Empire is invulnerable, what does that do to this conflict, even if there are still other X-Wings and other ships out there that can continue the fight?
I'm going to be real with you, Eric. I hate this prompt. I read it and I was like, man, that sucks. And here's why. Because it's not because it's a bad prompt. It's because I think it is just really dark and I don't see how there's any defeat of the Empire. And it's not just because of, you know, the rebellion suffering this massive loss on like a literal and moral emotional level, but also because if the idea is that the Death Star makes the Empire basically invulnerable, then yeah, it's basically invulnerable. If the Death Star works, if the Death Star still exists, then it's like basically over. And sure, maybe the flaw still exists, but how are you ever going to get close enough to it again? I just think the rebellion as it exists would be totally decimated. There would have to be a complete rethinking of approach, but also like it's just such a fundamental victory. Like we can destroy a whole planet. You see that with Alderaan. And not only can we destroy a whole planet, we can destroy the entire rebellion as well, basically in one fell swoop. Like, nowhere is safe. Your planet is not safe. Maybe there's a random X-Wing out there, but your major political minds are gone. Like, it's over. So that's, I mean, it's really hard for me to not think bleakest possible scenario there. Like, to me, they're genuinely... There's no coming back from that one.
Yeah, I think this one would be more of a Marvel what if where it's one episode and you don't try to suggest that like there's any true happily ever after victory possible. A lot of the Marvel ones do take place in an almost post-apocalyptic universe. Like what if Thanos won, you know, and it's kind of like what happens to the scraps of the universe, or like, you know, what happens if Ultron, you know, turned evil and killed everybody? Like a lot of that, I think this would be in that same vein of like more just satisfying like a fan desire to see a really gritty, like how would Luke cope with this universe? How would insurgency even take place? I think you're right. We're not looking at a series for this one. We're looking at a one-off.
Yeah, like it just, it's such a bummer to even think about. The only real hope that I see there is if you set it in the future, like if you make Luke the star of it and him figuring out what happens next, like that's just going to be a real bummer. But if you set it like 50 years in the future, if, you know, how has the rebellion slowly but surely sort of rekindled? What does that look like now? Like, how does Palpatine's decrepit clone, like, what's he doing there? Like, if you set it in the future, which I also think would be a one-off, I think that would be really interesting. But for me personally, like, I just straight up would not want to watch Luke be sad for half an hour. It would just be too much of a bummer for me.
Yeah, it's probably the grimmest idea that I came up with for sure. You've got another good one that I want to hear about though.
So I assume this is the what if Finn was, you know, actually got to become a Jedi and trained as a Jedi.
Yes.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot in this show about how one of our biggest pet peeves with the sequel series is how Finn is set up as like a co-equal hero and hinted at being a Jedi and being force sensitive in The Force Awakens, and then they go absolutely nowhere with that, and his plot is really shunted to the side in a way that's deeply disappointing. What if that didn't happen? And what if Finn's force sensitivity is treated with equal seriousness? And I think how this would probably look is what if he and Rey both go to Ahch-To? Is that the island where Luke is?
Yes.
What if they both go to that island together and go on that journey together? Because they are both force sensitive. They are both Jedi. Or have the potential to become Jedi. And I think that would be really cool. Be really interesting to see, you know, how he continues to play off of Rey in terms of, like, how she is more of the fiery personality and he's more of a measured but still, you know, can be very impulsive, as we see from the very beginning of his arc. But, like, he is someone with a really strong moral core. And I think as Rey struggles with her own morality, especially with Luke struggling with his morality too, what's it like to have this character who comes from this very difficult background and nonetheless has this very deep well of empathy and sense of right and wrong? And how does that affect Luke? How does that change the direction of his path as well? And I just think it's a real missed opportunity that could maybe be corrected.
Yeah, I mean, And I'm also thinking about the idea of a Jedi pair in the sequel trilogy. I mean, I think one of the great things about the prequels was that Anakin-Obi-Wan relationship. That obviously went in a specific direction because it needed to in order to set up the original trilogy. But with the sequels, you could do whatever you want with these two. You know, you can, you know, make them, you know, in a relationship. You can just have them be friends and coworkers and kind of build off of each other's strengths and support each other when one of them is, you know, as you said, when Rey is struggling, you know, Finn can be that moral compass for her and vice versa. And I just think in general, that dynamic of having two people who have the ability to contribute to the story in this way, I think it does something really interesting for the trilogy. I also wonder, like, in your view, would the rest of the meta plot be the same? Would we keep the dreaded Rey Palpatine idea? And would Finn, because in that story, Rey still kind of emerges as the main character, continuing the, like, Skywalker Palpatine conflict and story, which is what JJ said was his goal. And so Finn, I think, would become a little secondary there. Would you, I mean, as I'm asking it, I'm realizing, of course we would get rid of the Rey Palpatine if we could.
Yeah, of course
we would
get rid of Rey Palpatine.
But like, I guess what I'm asking is there a way for this still to be interesting and cool if you couldn't get rid of that?
I mean, yes, I fundamentally think yes. Because I think Finn becoming a Jedi would be just generally really interesting. And to be clear, like, I love Rose. Rose is one of my favorite characters in the sequel series. I would love to see her still go on some kind of journey and become a leader in the rebellion and have her storyline treated with some weight as well. I think what would really have to change for this to be satisfying to me, and the haters are gonna at me too, like, you gotta do something different with Kylo Ren's story. It's not gonna work with him being like a bad weirdo obsessed with Rey. Like, it's just not gonna work in the same way. I still think, I mean, Rey Palpatine, the plot line of that sucks. It just objectively does. There's nothing subjectively. Sorry. I suppose I can't say objectively, even though I am right objectively.
Yes.
but sub-objectively, it sucks. So there's just no way you can get around that. I think if Finn is a Jedi too, it makes it impactful. I think they can both go up against Palpatine. I gotta do something else with Kylo. Kylo's just, he's the thorn in my side here. I don't know what to do with him. I don't really have a good idea, but something, not that, like, not that.
Yeah, maybe Kylo, instead of fixating on Rey, in a world where Finn emerges as a Force-sensitive person too, and in a world where, let's say, you're getting rid of the Rey Palpatine thing, so, like, she doesn't have this dyad thing with Kylo, he might end up fixating on Finn, not romantically, although, sure, maybe, whatever, but, like, it could more just be, like, a rivalry thing. He could, for some reason, end up being more interested in, like, defeating Finn, or he could be vexed more by Finn in some way, and so then you don't have, you know, the classic kind of, like, Draco-Hermione thing that I think just really bothered a lot of people about the sequel trilogy if it's not, you know, the woman and the dark, you know, man, if it's, like, actually, like, it's two men who have this kind of rivalry, and does it become romantic or not, I don't think is, like, essential to this question. If, like, the two of them have this kind of dynamic, you know, then there's a question of, like, well, how does Rey fit into that?
Yeah, I think that's much more interesting to me. Like, I don't really like love triangles. Love triangles suck, but weird friendship rivalry triangles, now that's interesting to me. You can go somewhere with that. I think another great what if is just, what if Kylo is not a jerk? What if his character were entirely different? But then we'll be here all day.
So what if Finn tries to redeem Kylo And Rey is really suspicious of this, and this drives a wedge between them, and there's, like, kind of a reckoning about, like, redemption, and, like, is he actually worth trying to bring back to the good side? And maybe you change his role so that, like, he actually does seem like he's worth redeeming. I think there's a lot of controversy in the sequel trilogy as it is about whether he's worth redeeming. Maybe you make it a little easier for the audience to get behind his redemption. So then, like, there are people who take Finn's side and say, like, yeah, it's worth it, right? Like, but then you've got people on the Rey side who are seeing it as more just like, we can't give an inch to the dark side, or like, I don't trust that he's genuine. Like, I think you were saying, like, the idea of some kind of triangle is, like, interesting. And I think that's how I would do it, is I would have the two of them split, like, I would have Finn and Rey's relationship fracture over what to do about Kylo.
There's really only one more, like, alternate scenario that I want to discuss, and it's not really one that I actually want to discuss that seriously, but just one that personally bothers me and I think should be corrected. And spoilers for Star Wars Rebels ahead, so if you haven't seen it and plan to watch it, which you should just end now, press pause now. But I think in Star Wars Rebels, they should not kill Kanan. I think Kanan should live, because him dying in explosion, yeah, it has emotional weight, blah, blah, blah. But consider this, the emotional weight of him staying alive and being part of the rebellion and getting to raise his kid and getting to continue to be a mentor and friend and spouse person. So that's my... a big what if, a big pet peeve that I would like to see corrected in my perfect world. And then my episode of this would just be like him and Hera and baby Jason having a great day. Like them just vibing out on, I don't know, wherever they would be, on Yavin or even on Hoth, just like, you know, being a rebel power couple with their cute baby. Maybe Kanan doing, wearing one of those like baby slings and just like wandering around the rebel base in flip-flops, and they'll be like, hey, can you join the rebel meeting as a Jedi? And Kanan just being like, sorry, I'm on dad duty today, to avoid being in these meetings. That's my perfect what if scenario, is a domestic little comedy within the larger rebellion, but the important thing is Kanan lives.
Do we think he'd be a good dad, or do we think he'd have trouble?
He would be a great dad.
I'm not saying he's a bad person, I'm just saying, do we think like it would be an easy and natural role for him given the life he had leading up to that?
Well, of course not. But he's had experience dadding before. Like, he's dadded before with the teenagers who live on his ship. So I think he would be fine. He'd figure it out.
Yeah, would Ezra be a good, like, uncle, do we think?
Of course he would. What even are these questions, Eric? The answer is of course. Of course Ezra and Sabine and Zeb would be great continued found family, wonderful babysitters, constantly bringing treats. Like they would all babysit, do movie nights. It would be very domestic. This episode I have.
But you know what? I thought of one thing that could actually make this an interesting what if, which is, not that it's like a bad idea.
How
but just
dare
like,
you? This is well, so like, interesting to me. If Haley were here, she'd think it was interesting.
You're right, but I'm taking advantage of her not being here to say, no, it's interesting. But let me just say, let me add this. One of the big themes of the Ahsoka show was that Sabine was kind of unmoored because Kanan didn't get to finish her like training, and that, you know, leads to her having this uneasy relationship with Ahsoka. If Kanan had lived and been able to kind of like fully train Sabine, what would that have meant for Sabine's journey? I know it's kind of like a weird question because we're talking about Kanan here, but like, what effect would he have on other people if he had continued to be around, in particular for Sabine?
Only great effects, only good things.
I think she definitely would have been more at peace with herself, and probably by the time of the Ahsoka show, like if Ahsoka and her had ended up going on missions together, it it, you know, probably would have gone a little easier for her. She wouldn't have been frustrated and confused and doubtful of Ahsoka's lessons, because Kanan would have been able to actually prepare her more for the Jedi lifestyle. And that, but now I'm just getting mad because I'm thinking about Sabine having Force powers, which is a whole other can of worms. We don't have time to get into that here. But this was a great prompt, Grace. I'm glad you put this on the list. Even if you say that it doesn't have any plot ramifications, I would submit to you that my point here is it has some serious plot ramifications.
Okay, so I guess it does have plot ramifications, but I'm less interested in them. Like, this is truly a wish fulfillment for me for, like, coziness. But yes, there would be serious legitimate plot ramifications for sure for realsies. But for me, it's just like, what if something nice happened?
What if star peace?
What if star love?
All right, and with that, we are going to wrap up this episode of Hoth Takes. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or maybe suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com. You can also find us on all the major social media platforms, including X and Blue Sky. We are there at Hoth Takes. I am at Eric Geller on X. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. As always, we want to remind you that all of the Star Wars music and sound effects, they are owned by Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website. That's hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like our show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.